Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is part 3 of episode 42, where we are continuing to discuss the Barbara Levitt and James March 1988 article, Organizational Learning, that appeared in the Annual Review of Sociology. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
In the last parts, we have been talking about, you know, the paper, its relation to different themes, and one of the things that we explored was one of its limits, you know, and how we need to be specific about what kind of learning are we talking about, what kind of organizations are we talking about, and what even constitutes an organization. Another thing that the paper doesn't talk so much is maybe the opposite of its theme, that is unlearning, you know. So I wonder to what extent the messages and the ideas that are captured in the paper fit with our contemporary understanding that unlearning is sometimes as much part of learning as any other process.
Well, I don't think unlearning is... I'm not a big fan of the concept, just to put that right out there.
Oh.
I think it's... Okay.
Yeah, tell us.
Again, disclaimer, this is not a statement of fact. And you know, to our listeners, do your research before listening to what any of us have to say. I think unlearning is a misleading and possibly confusing concept because it's just, it's learning. Okay, unlearning is not something different. It's just learning something else, but it's being presented as almost a replacement or erasing or a refreshing of some kind of a previous state. It's very much... like, you know, the Lewin's traditional organizational change model where you unfreeze, change, and then freeze again. It's kind of like that, but with respect to information and knowledge. And from the research that I did and the things that I've read and the thinking that I have done, I don't think on a collective level, especially, you can't just remove information. You can drown it out and you can negate it, but you can't selectively take certain parts of a process out and sort of unlearn it and then replace it with a different learning. And I realized that this is an audio podcast, so when I said unlearning, I was very much using, you know, air quotes here where I am. So I see that how it's used is interesting, and there's a lot of implications for things like that I mentioned in part 2, like project amnesia and stuff like that, but I just don't see the, you know, the reason for it to be its own thing, and especially with such a misleading label on it.
Okay, so let's use an example from the podcast maybe to ground this. So in episode 11, we had the case of nuclear submarines in the discussion about culture and high reliability, and I mean, Ralph and Tom, you can help me here, but I remember that one of the issues there was that those spheres, you know, within the Navy, the nuclear submarines has a very kind of different way of operating. And one of the ideas is that, you know, people that are experts are allowed to speak up to leaders, whereas in the broader military, this is not accepted. So one might make the argument, to go back to what Ton was saying, you know, about new ventures within the military, that people that progress to this specific department in the army has to maybe unlearn part of their socialization, part of the way they do things, and because that has such a different culture and way to operate.
Right. That's a good point. And I would just say that I tend to agree with Demetrius that it's not necessarily like you're throwing it away, but you're learning a new way of doing business or what applies in this organization. And there is a bit of cultural resistance, and I'm sure Tom will talk about that, where you come in this new organization and a lot of times people don't want to hear what you used to do. So there's this whole social aspect of how that's received. And from personal experience, one of our biggest challenges on the nuclear aircraft carrier I was on was the people who came from the other organization with these different conceptions of what was important and how to train and how to learn and focus on performance. And so whether you want to call that unlearning and or call it teaching them the way that was acceptable in our circumstance, you could go either way on that. I share some of the misgivings Demetrius has in that you wonder if people are just bringing this up because it's a new thing or it's a different way to look at it. And I really agree with him when he says you just can't take something that somebody already knows or is aware of or has done before and just say, we're going to blank that out. Or you're just going to, you have to just unlearn that. It's kind of an artificial way to look at it. I think there are some benefits to the metaphor, but I'm a little skeptical myself.
Yeah, I mean, just even looking at the article itself, when we talk about routinization, okay, so you have learned something. Now your unlearning is essentially actually restoring the old way of doing business, which is just a second learning. That's the way that I look at it. Because now, if you talk about somebody coming in from another organization, let me start at the individual level. I join a different organization that has routines that are different than what I am accustomed to. I don't unlearn my routines. I merely suspend them. I try to push them out of my primary brain bucket, if you will, and adapt. But the moment that I leave that organization and go somewhere else, which routines am I more likely to fall back on? It's probably the ones in which I was already comfortable with. Or maybe the second organization has got me adjusted enough where I carry the new way of doing business forward. That becomes my new self. At the organization level, I'm trying to think of how to contextualize this where this sort of thing happens. When I was part of this one command that was standing up, we inherited a whole section of people from another command. And they brought in a wealth of experience, a wealth of knowledge, their own routines and all that sort of thing, and, you know, plopped them into the middle of this, in the middle of this cadre. And we tried to form a functioning organization around that. The rest of the cadre who were coming in from all other places, they basically had to learn anew, which is the way I will put it. Learn anew how to function in with this, you know, in a mission that they were not familiar with. And in some cases you had whole sections of folks who would come in and they would have to change their whole routine as a group to adapt to this new context. They all did it. It all worked out fine. But I still don't see anything really being unlearned because on an individual basis, as they all rotate out and move on to other commands, they'll each take their own experience with them, which may or may not have been influenced by this particular episode of being in a new command that did things differently. Kind of a long way around. That's why I kind of see that it's a continuous process of learning, and the history at each step is kind of important. That's where I definitely deviate from the unlearning concept. I say that you remember what you learned first, then what you tried to replace it with, and so on, and that whole history becomes a part of what you have learned. It's all part of your memory.
When the concept of unlearning was mentioned, I kind of automatically rejected it because I think it's a bit of a play on words in the sense that if learning is a continuous process, then I didn't really see the idea of taking steps backwards. But even if there is an outcome that seems to be going to the previous steps, it's actually a continuous learning and improvement in that sense. So I agree with your idea of you can't unlearn and just take something away. There will still be an addition and you will continue and it will, I don't know, it's just the idea of the continuous process dimension to it that made me think, well, at the end, it's learning, it's not unlearning.
Well, to be a slight devil's advocate here in the mold of Pedro, I think I agree with you what you're saying, Miranda, but I think it may be, I haven't really talked to the unlearning scholars when they present their papers. I'll have to ask about this, but it may be what they're trying to focus on is this idea of letting go, not necessarily of knowledge, but behavior and past routines. And it, maybe that's the language they're choosing to emphasize on that letting go and moving on process. Because I think learning is equivocal. It's a challenge to say, oh, I'm going to try to do this new thing like Tom was talking about.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to see maybe a practical example, because still in my mind, I just see a continuous, like even the letting go is a learning curve. But then again, I'm open to all ideas.
I agree with Ralph that we shouldn't represent the whole field of unlearning in simplistic terms. And it's not really about taking steps back. It's kind of more about maybe switching things. But more importantly, let's think of fundamentals. And fundamentally, the unlearning tradition is based on the premise of there being a possibility of a blank slate, right? So it's not necessarily enacting this, but this is literally an ancient view of memory. Like, you know, the Platonic memory is a wax tablet on which you imprint stuff and then that's stored. And this is very similar. So what Tom gave a great, rich example of how this happens. But just to add to that is that, you know, when you come into a new organization, it's not that necessarily just pack away your old way of things. It's you import that, and you, by doing so, you change not only your routines, your approaches, and your understandings, but also those of the organization that you come into. So even if you are removed from that new setting, it's not that everything reverts back to the way it was before you joined. It's you still make a difference and you make an impact by being there and trying to adapt to these new settings. And that's the blank slate idea, that in thinking that you can manipulate information, knowledge, processes, procedures in such a way as to superimpose particular states of the organization in space and time, but you can't. You know, you can't design a state of an organization in such deterministic ways. It's always changing, and there isn't a before that that can be returned to. Actually, in this paper, they allude to that very briefly in the part where they talk about memory, that organizational memory not only records history but shapes its future path, and it's kind of this more teleological way of viewing is that's kind of more prominent now in this respect. And that's why I think unlearning is a bit of a, you know.
One comment is that you see people in organizations often believing they can create this sort of blank slate effect or take advantage of it by changing terminology, right? So I know Tom has seen this and perhaps others where you'll come into an organization and they'll call things that are familiar outside the organization something brand new. You see this often in new ships where they'll change the names of the positions or they'll reorganize things and then this person will have a different name. Yeah, and I think you see that in other organizations too where they reorganize and give people different names and different titles. And it seems like organizational leaders are thinking that, or trying to take the approach, well, if I use a different name, you know, you'll think differently about this. And one of the best modern examples is the U.S. Navy's littoral combat ship. We never really had a ship like that, or we never really referred to our ships in terms of where they would operate. It was more their function in the fleet. And they had all these different names for what the ship was doing under the auspices of getting people to think differently, because you do get people coming from outside. And one of the best examples I can think of is I was on a frigate in the 1980s, and there were many parts about the way that ship was designed that were trying to drive new kinds of behaviors and new procedures and new routines. And I would get people coming in from other organizations saying, no, we need to redesign this ship so we can do it the way we used to. And I remember looking at one of the senior officers one time and saying, couldn't we just try to use it the way it's set up once to see if that works better, right? But he had came in with this metaphor of, yep, I had to have all these people talking on these electronic circuits doing these kind of things because that's the way we did it on my other ship. And even though our ship wasn't configured that way and didn't have that capability, he was going to force that into the sack no matter what. So I think there's a kind of a concrete example of the people coming in with this idea or these metaphors that they don't unlearn or they don't modify, they don't let go of. And then it's hard for them to imagine, oh, I have this different hardware. And then I think that's a designer's conceit, right? That, oh, I'll create new hardware or a new phone that doesn't have a button and I'll just get people to behave differently because I will constrain them with the actual hardware that's capable. And I think, as Demetrius is pointing out, people tend to be a lot more resilient than you expect, and it's not like they just go down this new path easily.
I'm not going to weigh down the podcast with all kinds of examples, but I've got a ton of them.
I bet you do.
And I would say that I think a way to put it is that sometimes it's a we try to enact change symbolically, yes. Where the symbol just. It's a slogan. It's a black beret. It's something else that is trying to convey a sense of change or to point the organization in some sort of a direction to try to spur new routines, new ways of looking at things. But it's just simply misaligned with what the expectations of the members are. They don't understand it. They become ambivalent towards it, and they just reject it. I've seen it so many times. It's not funny. But anyway,
that's a great point. And the Navy's had its own black beret experiences with uniforms in the past. Even though we tend to be a lot more resistant, that's why the U.S. Navy has this working uniform that's blue camouflage. Because I think they had camouflage envy or you know, everybody had these really spiffy camouflage uniforms and we didn't have them. And so in the Navy, they were derisively referred to as aquaflage. And the trouble is, you look at the uniform, you say, well, what if that guy falls over the side of the ship? He's going to blend in with the ocean. And that's like the last thing you want. And so I used to tell people, if I fell over the side of the ship, first thing I'm doing is taking my shirt off so you can see my white skin and you might be able to recognize me. Yeah.
Now we're kind of laughing, but you know, there's kind of an important point in this that I think relates well with the article. Is that in a lot of ways, you know, the leaders are under pressure. We recognize that leaders are under pressure to enact change in the organization. And part of it is out of recognition that old ways of doing business, all of the things that organizations have learned, have stored in their memory, et cetera, is not what should be for the purposes of facing the dynamic and complex and competitive environments in which they currently reside. And so doing nothing is certainly not an option. The doing something, unfortunately, is really, really hard. And like we talked before, there's a desire to, you know, cut to the chase, get to the simple answer. And the simple answer, what do we gravitate towards? Something that's symbolic. And that's somehow it's a habit that I think a number of organizations have fallen into. And the question is, how do you break that cycle? How do you reel it back and try to get away, try to make or spur organizational learning in a more constructive fashion rather than
not using gimmicks go after and that. Slogans?
Yeah, to use a gimmick and all that. You're right.
Right. So one last comment I want to make on this, and I know Pedro wants to bring up something else. There's a great quote in the article on page 330, and it really gets at the heart of what Tom is talking about. And it's that pressure on organizations exists to demonstrate they are acting on collectively valued purposes. I thought that was really – I didn't really quite get it when they first wrote it, but now I listen to Tom's example, and I'm thinking, oh, I think that's what they're talking about.
Yeah, so I was thinking about different settings, you know, so departing away from the military world and thinking more about other kind of organizations, and especially in light to gig work and online labor becoming more prominent. You know, I had an interesting offline chat with our colleague Greta, who works at the Oxford Internet Institute and has been doing research on exactly these things, you know. So how can we think about learning in these current settings? When we have collective intelligence, when we have open innovation, when we have part of the work being distributed and being assigned through algorithms or through online platforms, you know, how does this complicate the picture?
Well, I think that's a great point because you have this whole aspect of atomizing your workforce, right, where you have all these distributed workers that often don't have means to communicate, and yet they do, right? They create websites where they can share ideas and share learning. And there have been some articles written recently that escaped me, but it was about, some of it was about how Uber drivers learn and learn to get better and increase their income via some of this individual learning. And you wonder, does that, how well that translates in a kind of an organizational learning setting.
Is there such a thing as a collective intelligence, though?
Well,
is what the question that I have.
For instance, all the people that study, I think, open innovation, I'm not an expert myself, but you can argue that, you know, firms use the crowd to solve issues that they could otherwise not necessarily they would have handled that way. You know, the famous example of NASA and the use of open innovation, I think, to predict solar storms, that was actually an innovation that came from someone from a complete different field. So I think that's what I'm trying to hint at.
But I'm wondering if this is also an issue to do with where are the boundaries of the organization, which relates to a future topic, by the way.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they do mention intelligence in this paper as well. Like, they don't say collective intelligence, I think, explicitly, but I think that's what's implied. And just thinking about the kind of the digital economy and the platforms and gigs and all that kind of stuff, it's not, I think it's not really appropriate to label that as collective intelligence, because it's not the collective that does the intelligencing, right? It's the algorithms and it's the distribution of demand, supply, and the bits and pieces of work that needs to be accomplished. So it's just displaced traditional learning mechanisms rather than any kind of real intelligence. And even then, like, even looking at this paper, so let's go back to 88, and they talk about intelligence as the intelligence of learning, and they're really unsure about this whole thing. It's probably the shortest bit in the paper by far, and they're really ambivalent about what is, or even if it's a good thing. Or, as I mentioned, organizations have an information processing characteristic, but intelligence is it's a bit of a step too far, don't you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there is the label that's called collective intelligence. I just went on Wikipedia and it says collective, it defines it in this way. Collective intelligence is a shared or group intelligence that emerges from the collaboration, collective efforts, and competition of many individuals and appears in consensual decision making. You know, and you can expand that and talk about the idea that actually intelligence is emergent, because it's not necessarily something that comes from, I mean, the individual or just interactions, but something that spans across beyond the organization and when people come together, for instance, to problem solve. So I think that's what, whether it is, we can call it intelligence or not, I don't know. But the issue is that how do we can make sense of learning or even intelligence in a time in which the boundaries seem to be more porous of the organization?
I think you have a point. I also think Demetrios had a great observation that I didn't see until just now about the authors being conflicted on this intelligence of learning. I mean, that appears on page 335. And they actually start out with, the concept of intelligence is ambiguous when action and learning occur simultaneously at several nested levels of a system, which I thought was really interesting. And in the second paragraph, on that last paragraph on that page, they say, and I think this gets right to Demetrios's point, there are severe limitations to organizational learning as an instrument of intelligence. Learning does not always lead to intelligent behavior. Wow.
That's where I was going.
That's a great point. Keep going.
Collective intelligence is certainly a thing, but is it a thing in the context of organizational learning? And I think it probably isn't. And I think what Miranda said about the boundaries of organization and where they begin and or what they span is of prime importance here. But more importantly than that, I think, is a question of why would we even want organizations or collectives to be intelligent, and what would that mean? And I think it's just to a large extent an artifact of this psychologistic image of what an organization is. That if we think of it as an information processing entity, then it can learn. If it can learn, it needs a memory. If it can learn and it has a memory, then, you know, next step is, hey, what about intelligence or wisdom or kind of this emotional and affective states? That it's just, it's taking it a tad too far down this anthropomorphic path of what organizations are or how these processes play out in them that we label in these familiar kind of intuitive terms.
Well, I think that's a good example of possibly taking the metaphor too far, right? Unless you think carefully about the metaphor you're using and what its limitations are, you can go off in kind of some strange directions, which I think is one of the things that Gareth Morgan challenges us to do, is to be careful of.
Well, you need to be aware that it's a metaphor as well, right?
Absolutely.
Because I remember going to a conference a few years ago, and there's people talking about things like, what was it, organizational mindfulness. And it's all tacking on to this idea, which is, by the way, not empirically substantiated, that organizations, that collectives function on this learning landscape in a similar way that brains do. That.
To that end, let me add another metaphor. And this comes from when Ralph and I were at George Washington. We had a guest lecturer come in. This was very early in our program. And we're in a program of human and organizational learning. And the guest speaker comes in, and in response to the first question, because he was basically a consultant and spent a lot of time with organizations. And I think I don't remember exactly what the question was or who asked it, but it was something like this. Do you think organizations learn? And his response was, no, organizations do not learn. And you remember that, right?
Yeah, I remember that. That was a pretty shocking statement.
It's interesting, yeah. You know, given the program that we were in. But I just sort of kind of raised that you know, a lot of the things that we've been talking about in terms of organization learning is up against, I think, a level of cynicism that's built up out there in the field, if you will, that organizational learning is interesting as a process, but is it useful in terms of generating good outcomes? Especially if the lessons that are being learned or captured in organizations are the bad habits or, say, reactions to crisis that lead the organization to become defensive or whatever, basically going in the complete opposite direction of what we've been talking about with learning organizations earlier in this part. I just wonder about that.
I think it's not a choice, and I think it sometimes can seem that way, that it's a dichotomy between either individuals learn or collectives learn. And that's not true. That's not everything we have to work with. I mean, there are examples and evidence that support the claim that organizations can learn as a collective kind of phenomenon. And there is lots of support and evidence that say that, no, if we talk about learning and memory, that's all what individuals can do, or that's what we can reliably observe and measure individuals do and not collectives, because they simply don't have the, you know, what we have for a brain. They don't have anything like that. But it's not this or that when we necessarily have to think about things. And while... this sentiment is not reflected in the paper that we're discussing today, there is more sensitivity to a more complex picture of where organization is more like a prism for individual learnings, that it's not deterministic, it's not imposing, but it has a role, and it has a role in sort of directing and refracting and reflecting certain types of information, knowledge, procedures, practices in these goal-oriented directions, not everywhere in the same way and not to the same extent and not always successfully, but it's has a part to play in what we would term as organizational learning. But I think recognizing that makes it a useful metaphor and even can result in it being a useful tool in organizational design, change analysis, and so on and so forth. But I mean, that's not to say that this is a commonly taken position on learning and organizations. And just thinking of things like, you know, absorptive capacity, like an offshoot of organizational learning. Not going to go too much into that, but because that's not what we're discussing. But an idea that an organization has capacity to absorb some knowledge and not other is just very simplistic. It's a simplistic view of learning and knowledge, right? And I know I'm going to piss off a lot of people by saying that, but yeah. But I mean, even the language of the metaphor of developing certain sponge-like characteristics in certain parts of the organization is very much presupposing the presence of some kind of a brain-like property that organizations have. And that's just, again, taking the metaphor too far. A prism, I'll go with, shaping, directing, but a sponge or a plate or a slate, that's just not empirically substantiated in a way that is critical.
Right, as long as it's a prism and not a prison, that would be a problem.
Well, I mean, that's up to your personal preference, but
so I think I'm going to share my usual, you know, reflection, which is about the role of the paper in creating, it's the role of the paper in constructing the field that we inhabit today. You know, I think the overall Carnegie Mellon tradition and the paper in specific helps in showing what is organizational about learning. And we discuss a lot about that, you know, how the way that work is structured, what kind of organization we are talking about, the way things are organized, and the existence of departments or not may shape learning. And I think while the paper might not go that far, I think it does the first step in going that direction, in thinking of learning not just in something that, you know, happens for an individual, but there is something emergent and particular about the ways organizational may learn.
And that's all for part 3 of episode 42. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about our podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time here on Talking About Organizations.